much of the opposition to kind of civil rights, post-Civil Rights Act, you know, 1964 and 1965, so the majority of evangelicals were okay with that. And then they thought, okay, we're good. That's good. Anything beyond that could easily get dismantled as, you know, disrupting the social order. So law and order politics, really strong by the late 60s and certainly by the 70s in evangelical circles. And yes, Marxism, tying it with Marxism. Also, you know, slightly less extreme, so this isn't socialism or Marxism, but it's big government, and we're anti-big government. And of course, in that moment, what is the big government doing? What is the federal government doing? They are interfering with states' rights in order to enforce desegregation.
Welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality.
Hey, Elliot here, and I just thought I would pop in. You know, as I was editing, I thought it might be unclear that this episode was recorded prior to the insurrection that we saw play out last week as Trump supporters overtook the Capitol. And so you're not going to hear that reference specifically. That said, it's amazing to see how the topics that we covered continue to play out as history in front of our eyes. And so I found this to be a really insightful conversation, one of my favorite episodes to date. It also started with one of my favorite tastings to date. So we'll hop back in there.
Just in case there's some new listeners, hopefully there are, so welcome. And what we do on the show, this is A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar, after all. We do a tasting of some spirit, and I don't mean the Holy Spirit, of usually whiskey or beer, and we talk about it a little bit because we like to have conversations that happen in a bar that you might have in a bar. So, Kyle, what are we drinking today?
So today we are drinking one of my favorite go-to bourbons, if I can find it, which is not that likely anymore. It used to be easy to find, but it's one of those that has become popular, and so now it's snatched up immediately. This is Weller Special Reserve Bourbon. Comes in at 45% alcohol by volume. It's a wheated bourbon. In fact, they claim that it's the first wheated bourbon. I don't know the history of that, but that means that wheat is the main secondary grain in the mash bill, and this is distilled by Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky.
I mean, how many amazing brands of bourbon come out of Buffalo Trace Distillery?
Yeah, all the most hyped ones pretty much at this point, or almost all of them.
Yep. So this is Weller Special Reserve. Is there a Weller non-special reserve?
There are a few different varieties of Weller. This is probably the easiest to find, or this one, or maybe one called Weller Antique, I believe it's called Antique 107 or something like that. There's a 12-year that's pretty difficult to find that is fantastic. If you ever find a bottle, snatch it up immediately. And then they have some other expressions that are exceedingly rare. There's a William LaRue Weller, which is the full name of the guy it's named after. It's part of the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection. And if you ever find a bottle of that, don't tell anyone where you found it.
Buy them all.
And keep it and open it on a special occasion. That actually is the best bourbon I've ever had. Maybe the best whiskey I've ever had, the William LaRue Weller.
Wow.
Yeah, this doesn't quite approach that, but nonetheless, it's in the same family, and I think it's delicious.
Now I feel like I'm getting cheated. Like, this, there's something better than this.
Well, here we go, Weller. The nose is hot. I haven't tasted it yet.
Yeah, I find this to be this line of bourbons to be some of the best balance. They have that hit of sweetness on the front because of the wheat, but they're just really well balanced. The spice, the caramel notes, a little bit of black pepper on the end.
Yeah, the way that the spice layers on top of the vanilla and the sweetness is just really delicious.
It's so much more mild than and easy drinking than I thought it was going to be. When I heard that it was 45%, when I smelled it even, it smelled hot to me. It smelled sweet, but it's very luscious and it has a great mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. It's not hot on the tongue. It's rich. It's got these low notes. It doesn't have the, you can tell it's wheated. That's what I think is that part that it's wheated. The rye isn't very high in there, so it's not super spicy. It just brings a lot of caramely stuff. It brings a lot of oak. It brings a lot of that barrel, but without the heat and the spice.
Yeah. Now imagine that this sat for There's no age statement on William LaRue Weller, so I don't know exactly how long, but imagine this sat for several more years in
good
a barrel.
Grief.
Imagine what that would do to it.
Yeah, delicious.
Yeah, this is incredible, but it is also, like you say, incredibly hard to find.
Yeah, nowadays it kind of is. You kind of have to get lucky or trade for it or something.
If you can't find it, though, it's, what, 30, 35 bucks? Like, it's not that much if you're able to find it on the shelf.
Yeah, it shouldn't be much more than that.
Wow. Well, if you do find it, get it.
Yep.
Buy it. Buy a couple of them. Keep them to impress people. Maybe buy an extra. Well, we wouldn't encourage people selling them on aftermarkets or anything.
No,
but
don't do that. You're part of the problem.
We have a fun episode for you today. Really, really fun, actually. There's this book that came out in 2020 that's really rocked a lot of boats, particularly within the church and within evangelicalism, called Jesus and John Wayne. And we get to talk to the author, Dr. Kristen Cobus-Dume. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
I read your book, Jesus and John Wayne, for a sermon series, actually, that we did this fall. And I was pretty much living that entire time with my jaw on the ground. So I'm super, super excited to have you with us today. We've got a bunch of questions for you. But
sorry
would love
about
to
that.
Know. Yeah.
Sorry, not
yeah.
sorry. It was a fascinating book and I couldn't hold back. So,
and this outline is after I told Kyle he had to take several questions off. It was just too much. Can you, Kristen, is that okay if we call you Kristen?
Yes, please.
All right. Kristen, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what got you to where you are now?
Sure. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, Sioux Center, Iowa. It's a very kind of conservative enclave. I grew up in a Dutch community, a Christian Reformed church, and so rather isolated in retrospect, I can see. My family moved to Florida for a couple of years while I was in high school, and then I ended up being an exchange student in Germany, so I did see a bit of the world. But then I came back to Sioux Center and went to college at Dort, a Christian university. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went off to study religious and intellectual history at the University of Notre Dame. And my very first semester there, just a few weeks in, I encountered my first book of women's history, gender studies. And it just rocked my world, and I completely shifted my course of study. I kept the study of American religious history, but added a field in women's history and gender. And I just was fascinated by how ideas of masculinity and femininity changed over time, how they were linked to all sorts of broader shifts, economic shifts, foreign policy. And I think you can kind of see how one thing led to another. My first book was actually A History of Christian Feminism. And this book actually grew out of a conversation that I had with some students about 15 years ago who introduced me to John Eldredge's Wild at Heart and conceptions of kind of militant Christian manhood. And this was right during the early years of the Iraq War. And I started wondering what these militant conceptions of masculinity might have to do with the survey data that was coming out at the time that white evangelicals were far and away more likely to support the war, to support preemptive war, condone the use of torture, and you know, this militarism that was very pronounced. And so that really set me on the path eventually to write Jesus and John Wayne.
So you've been working on this for 15 years.
No. So I started, I should fill in the gaps there. I did start for about a year kind of playing around. This was before I'd written my first book, which had grown out of my dissertation. So I had a few other things going on, but I was just dabbling in this project. And then I ended up setting it aside for a couple of reasons. I had two kids in quick succession and realized I couldn't write two books at once. And but also I was really disturbed by what I was discovering. I found it revolting, frankly. It was deeply misogynistic.
I was going to say, how do you write about this for 15 years?
Oh my gosh, no. I that was part of the reason I set it aside. But related to that, it wasn't clear to me how mainstream this all was, right? So I was wondering, am I just seeing this fringe movement? And do I need to be shining this bright light on what might be the darkest underbelly of American Christianity? Mm-hmm. Is this worth the effort, and does this need to be done? And I just wasn't really sure. So I set it aside, took up other projects. Life kind of happened. And then it was in the fall of 2016, actually in the weeks after the Access Hollywood tape released, that I thought, I need to dust off that old research. I'm seeing some things come together, and particularly that question of how much of this is really fringe and how much of it is really close to the mainstream was solved at that point.
That's actually a great segue into my first question about the book. So one of my area of research, I'm an epistemologist, and I've recently been thinking a lot about echo chambers and public trust and that sort of thing, which is highly relevant to many of the aspects of the book. And so I'm curious, just right off the bat, where you landed, I guess, on that question of is it mainstream? Is it fringe? Is it a cult? Because there are some stark similarities between the ways that evangelicals have organized themselves socially and the ways that groups that anyone would recognize as a cult organize themselves, and also similarities in thought patterns. So one piece of the book that made me think of this in particular is you were talking about John Wayne's movies, The Alamo and The Green Berets, and at one point you said the fact that those movies were viciously panned and vilified was a point in their favor for a lot of evangelicals. And that's like a classic feature of cults or echo chambers, right? The you're like immunized against critique. You encounter the critique, but it doesn't have an impact because you've already been told what to think about it.
Yeah.
That's like classic cult move, and that's exactly what evangelicals do. So is it fair to call evangelicalism a cult at this point?
So I'm not an expert on cults, but I do know enough to know to be careful with that terminology, right? There's a kind of popular usage, and then there's a more technical usage. I think it would be fair to call some of these more extreme communities within evangelicalism cult-like, and I'm thinking here particularly some of the independent fundamental Baptist communities. And then evangelicalism writ large, there are some tendencies, as you suggest, this kind of inoculation against external critique, this persecution complex, really the sense of, you know, us versus them, and that we hold the truth. We hold God's truth, and anybody outside of these walls, outside of this community, they do not have the source of truth, and so why would we want to empower them? And so there are certainly some tendencies that I think run parallel. That said, no, I don't think most white evangelicals are in a cult right now. What fascinated me, though, was the relationship between the more mainstream, the more moderate, if you will, evangelicals, and the more fringe parts of the movement. And I think that's a theme that you can see running through this book, is me trying to test out, okay, you've got Bill Gothard here, and then you got James Dobson. Gothard, definitely extreme. James Dobson, pretty mainstream as far as evangelicalism goes. At the end of the day, they're saying things that are really quite similar. Mm-hmm. And so that's what fascinated me. What's the connection and what are the affinities between the moderate, quote unquote, respectable mainstream evangelicals, even, you know, institutions like Christianity Today, and then these more fringe movements, and how are the alliances forged and boundaries drawn? So who's inside? Who do we consider my brother in Christ? And then who gets excluded ultimately? Who's going to be pushed out of the communion? Who's going to be pushed out of the community? And that's really where I ended up. And so what I see is that there are some strong affinities between the mainstream and more fringe movements. And then and that's probably as far as I could go discussing whether or not this is a cult, although some of the behaviors, the practices are certainly worth examining.
Mm-hmm. Another kind of somewhat related to this thing that I've noticed being an evangelical my whole life and only recently having given up the label, and largely as a result of higher education, which is exactly what my parents warned me about, right? So I'm pretty sure my parents think I'm no longer a Christian because I got educated. But interestingly, in that, there seemed to be a double standard. And this is also something I was reminded of in the book when you were talking about James Dobson. Like, people like my parents, for example, or other strongly conservative evangelicals that I know, they buy wholesale into this. There's an academic cultural elite that is against the common person, and the average person would include most white evangelicals, until one of their own gets credentialed by the elite. And then they're like trumpeted as, you know, look, they're giving it to the man. And Dobson's a good example of this, right? Because he got the credentials from the respected university, and then he used it for evangelical purposes. So, like, how should we understand that kind of seeming double standard there?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think you got that exactly right. There's a real suspicion of, again, of outsiders, of outside knowledge, of outside expertise. That was something that It was very clear through my research, you know, decades ago, evangelicals were saying, you know, we need our own media. Don't consume mainstream media, mainstream news. We need our own, you know, news organizations. We need our own magazines. We need our own, you know, we have our own Christian contemporary music and all of that, this evangelical subculture. And that was developed, and it was so strong because they were rejecting so much of the mainstream culture at the time and continuing to today. And I think we see the same thing with kind of academic expertise, that if it is one of our own, and if we can then hold that up as, see, we can do it, but we can do it even better. And that then they gain this real status within evangelicalism. And you can see that with scholars, with academics. I think somebody like Eric Metaxas is kind of an interesting example here, where, you know, just even 5 years ago, or maybe we need to go 6 years ago, but certainly 10 years ago, you know, he was known as kind of the evangelical intellectual. And he could hold his own, Socrates in the City and so on. And he was really, admired for that he could kind of go toe-to-toe with the brightest, the best and the brightest, and in New York City of all places. And, you know, it's been interesting to see what he's become, especially in recent years and recent weeks. And to wonder what that was, right? That was just an act. Has evangelicalism changed so much? You know, I think in some ways it has, but now there's a different appeal. And being the suave intellectual isn't where it's at all anymore. It's really, I think, given in to this populist movement. And Metaxas, 4 or 5 years ago, saw where it was going. He was very astute and kind of changed his tune. And now he's trying to do the populist thing, which may or may not work out well for him.
Maybe he'll run for president in 4 years.
Oh, God.
My first thing in your book, and again, that's Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. But the first light bulb that went on was when you talked about how bookstores, of all places, are kind of like the key holders and the stakeholders in who's in and who's out, really. Like, you have, I grew up going to Family Christian Store, you know, I mean, I say that to my shame, but Family Christian Store, Lifeway, what is it, Lifeway Publishers?
Books, yeah.
Yeah. Funded by the SBC. Basically, this reality that maybe 3-4 guys who have power within evangelicalism, who are kind of self-appointed and also just seen as being the end-all be-all, the authority, if and when they decide that Rachel Held Evans is no longer in the camp, or Jen Hatmaker is no longer Christian, she's now a heretic, or Rob Bell, goodbye Rob Bell from John Piper, the minute that they decide that, these bookstores take their stuff off the shelves and immediately they become irrelevant heretics that nobody ever talks about. That blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah, that is how that works. And, you know, the Christian bookstore, I really lament as a researcher that Christian bookstore chains have gone out of business, because as research practice, every month or so, walk through a Christian bookstore long before I knew I'd be writing this book, just to kind of take the pulse of evangelical consumer culture. You know, which books are being, you know, promoted, which books are, you know, on the shelves, what sorts of home decor, those sorts of things. And so it always fascinated me. And I think this is autobiographical a bit too, because I talked about growing up in a kind of ethnic enclave. I did not identify as evangelical, even though it was very conservative Christian. It was in the Christian Reformed tradition. And my tradition really long identified over against American evangelicalism. We were distinctive. And so I never identified as an evangelical. That said, when I met real evangelicals, when I went off to Notre Dame, which is not where you would think you would go to meet evangelicals, turns out there are a lot of folks there studying with my advisor at the time, George Marston, who were coming from Moody Bible Institute, coming from Bob Jones, coming from Wheaton College. And so I met real evangelicals. And the points of connection that we had were precisely the popular culture. Because in my hometown, a town of 6,000 people, there was one bookstore. It was a Christian bookstore, right? And so I was exposed, even though I never identified as an evangelical. I was always Calvinist, Christian Reformed, Dutch. But my whole cultural formation in the faith was the books that were sold there, the music that was sold there. You know, every kind of graduation or major life event, I would get a wall plaque that had some Bible verse or saying on it. The latest Chuck Colson book, right, was gifted to me. And so I was very much participating in that subculture and the consumer culture, even though I didn't attend what I considered an evangelical church or even identify as an evangelical.
Mm-hmm. So, Kristen, just because you went there, what was in the playlist of Kristen Cobez growing up in high school?
All right, let's talk. So, Jars of Clay. Yes. That's going to date me. But before that, even Petra. Oh my gosh, Don't Let Your Hearts Be Hardened. Amy Grant, of course. Always
in
Amy
love
Grant.
With her.
Michael
yep.
Card. So a little better taste.
Wow, that's deep.
Right. Let's see what else.
Michael W. Smith.
Absolutely, Michael W. Smith. And then. My one kind of secular purchase, which Uh-oh. Was really bad. I didn't listen to secular radio at all. I considered that disobedient. But I gave in to temptation and bought a Tiffany cassette.
No!
Tiffany. So my parents, when they actually heard the lyrics, were not super thrilled. We had to have a talk about that. But yeah, that's as much as I dabbled in actual popular music.
Wow. I mean, judging by who you listen to, we must be really close in age because those were all mine. Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. We could do a whole little like mini episode on 80s and 90s Christian contemporary music.
Evangelical pop culture.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So I do have one question that it's about a topic that doesn't have a very prominent place in the book, but you say at one point, and this is a quote, same-sex relationships challenge the most basic assumptions of the evangelical worldview. So most of the book is about gender complementarianism and women's issues, and occasionally you touch on the LGBTQ stuff. So would you mind fleshing out that statement for us?
Sure. Yeah, I could have written more on that. That was one of the topics that I kept thinking, can I do more? Can I? Do I have space? I was really, really up against word count in this book, way over. Actually, I had to trim it back considerably. And then pulling together so many different threads through the book. And so I was wondering, could I add that? Really, I could have done more on same-sex relationships and more on abortion. Both of those are part of this narrative, but not a major part. And what I meant by that is, you know, when I really started to think about, you know, the hot-button issues that emerged in the religious right, both abortion and same-sex marriage, both of those really went against this all-important gender difference as a fundamental kind of ordering of creation, ordering of society, that God made men and women utterly different. And that these distinct gender roles that, you know, men were protectors and providers and women were weak and submissive and they needed to, you know, be very feminine and protected and just utterly distinct. You know, Dobson makes that very clear. Mm-hmm. That was really the fundamental difference. And then marriage was, you know, where you bring difference together in a hierarchical relationship, which again orders society. And then the rest of society is built upon that relationship. And that was so fundamental. So same-sex relationships just completely blew that out of the water, right? Gender difference, this complementarian relationship, the building blocks of society, which they believed was, you know, God ordained throughout all of time, the marker of faithful, you know, obedient Christianity. And so really for me, it was trying to understand why was that such a hot button issue in ways that others, other issues were not. And you could say, well, you know, Christians have always been, you know, against quote unquote homosexuality until you start looking at history and it's a lot more complicated. And yes, there certainly is this long tradition of opposition, but there's also a lot of fluidity, especially look at the history of sexuality and then the relationship between Christianity and this history of sexuality. And it's just much more complicated, but it certainly became a flashpoint. And in the 1960s, in the 1970s, as did abortion, right? And abortion, I think, is in some ways a clearer sense of it became a flashpoint not as early as we would have thought it would be, right? It was not at the origins of the rise of the religious right. It came along a little bit later when it was really identified with this idea of what is a woman's proper role, when it was identified with feminism threatening that appropriate role, that's when evangelicals really coalesced as a kind of pro-life movement, whereas in the late 60s, many evangelicals, including conservative evangelicals, had very mixed views on abortion. It wasn't a great thing. It was sometimes necessary. It was sometimes needed. It was just not this flashpoint that it would become just even a decade later in the context of this real kind of doubling down on gender difference and family values as just the foundation of religious orthodoxy and over against feminism, over against these disruptions of the 1960s and 1970s. So I really just wanted to historicize it. And rather than start with abortion, homosexuality, always these contentious issues, that they became that way as part of a broader historical context. And we should understand them in that sense.
In the chapter, God's Gift to Man, where you talk about these major feminine voices within evangelicalism, starting at Mirabel Morgan, Phyllis Schlafly, Elizabeth Elliot, and all sorts of them, who basically actively worked against feminism and against the Equal Rights Amendment and equal rights for women, equal pay. The whole thing blew me away. It reminds me to Candace Owens and people like her, these African-American folks who will just say really loudly that racism is not a thing and it's just an imagined thing and here's all the reasons. And then basically what that does, it seems to me, is it gives a lot of white evangelical Americans the right to say, hey, see, that African-American woman said racism isn't a thing, so I'm right and it's okay for me to be racist. What's going on there? You're a woman.
Yes.
And you've researched that. You've researched that. I mean, were you equally as appalled? I mean, what's that dynamic? What's the reasoning and the rationale behind that, do you think?
So I'd say a difference between what we see in the 60s and 70s and even to today with conservative white evangelical women and somebody like Candace Owens is that the evangelical women who are leaders, who are, you know, kind of gain celebrity status by promoting this conservative femininity represent far more white evangelical mm-hmm. women than Candace Owens would represent, you know, African Americans in this country. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it's somewhat different. And within evangelicalism, women like, you know, Beverly LaHaye or, you know, Phyllis Schlafly was Catholic, but I kind of consider her an honorary evangelical because evangelicals embraced her and she was extremely influential within evangelical circles. But women like Elizabeth Elliot, and so they're not just, they don't just give cover. They really do inspire. They represent other conservative evangelical women, and they inspire conservative women to embrace this understanding of what it means to be a faithful Christian woman. And that just comes through over and over again. When I looked at what was going on in the 60s and 70s, I was horrified when I knew kind of where it ended up, but I really understood, I think, where many of these women were coming from. Because even though I identify as a feminist and I'm very grateful for the opportunities that feminism has given to me, when kind of feminism is just kind of, you know, announced, it comes on the scene in dramatic ways in the 1970s, and many women had already kind of made life choices. Many women already didn't have the education they would need to have much mm-hmm. of a career. Many women had opted out of careers. Many women were at home with 3 or 4 kids. Right, they had no real economic prospects. And so for women in those situations, being told, hey, guess what, you're equal, or being told in a fear-mongering kind of way, they are going to take away your femininity, they're going to force you to be like men, they're going to force you to go fight wars, they're going to force you to go earn your keep. Good luck mm-hmm. with that, right? And that's the messaging that they were getting. You can see where for many women, this was not liberation. Mm-hmm. This was scary. And they had already made their choices. And so it was kind of, you know, playing with the hand that you were dealt. But then, again, I don't want to detract from the fact that so many conservative Christian women truly believed that the way to be a godly woman, the way to honor God and be faithful to Christ, really, was to live this domesticity, this conservative femininity. And I just don't think we can undersell that. And that is still the case for so many women that I meet today, including many of my students, right? I teach at a Christian university, and the messaging is still very powerful that as a Christian woman, you have certain duties, and these have to come first. And these other things are likely to distract from those. And you just, you know, you can get an education, great. You can start a career if you like, but just make sure that you have your priorities straight in order to really honor God with your life. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real sincere faith that's also at play. But that faith, of course, has been formed by generations of teachings, of preaching from the pulpit, of books by Elizabeth Elliot, you know, organizations like Beverly LaHaye. And so this is not just an organic kind of understanding. This is an ideology that has been perpetuated for generations in very, very powerful ways.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking of like really good friends of mine who to this day would probably have a hard time conceptualizing a Christian life without the influence of somebody like Elizabeth Elliot. I think it's really difficult to overstate the influence that she had. And outside of the evangelical subculture, nobody seems to have heard of her. But within it, like the sort of fundamentalist campus ministry that I was in college, there were two books that were required reading for everyone in that group. One was, I think it was called Passion and Purity.
Yeah.
Every woman in the group had to read that book, and every man was expected to read the one that she wrote to her nephew, The Mark of a Man, or whatever
it
was called.
Right, right. Oh, interesting.
And as an impressionable 20-year-old, I was kind of convinced by it because she, maybe uniquely, I'm not sure, she is the clearest that I found amongst the complementarians on rooting that kind of understanding of gender in an understanding of the Trinity.
Yes.
She's very explicit about it.
She is.
And so it gives you this like unshakable theological grounding for why it is this way and why it obviously must be this way.
Exactly, exactly. She kind of led the way with that, what some people would call heresy and others would defend as biblical truth today, right? The the eternal subordination of the Son as a model of the eternal subordination of women.
Oof. I mean, that's just a
serious...
Which is
hilarious and ironic that was that idea...
It came from a woman. right.
That's the maddening thing to me, though, is, I mean, I've had conversations like this. I'm sure you guys have. I'm sure listeners have, where you're talking with a woman and you're trying to convince her of her, it's not her value because she'd say I'm valuable, but that like she's got more in her than she thinks. And she's arguing with you against that. That's a crazy, crazy thing. And it makes me a little upset at some of, you know, the Elizabeth Elliots of the world, because that is such a powerful thing, that tool that they have there is, you know, that misogynistic men and leaders can continue suppressing women because of the females that say, no, this is great. This is the way we're created. This should be. That's a powerful argument.
Right. And some women are wired to really, you know, enjoy, you know, some women really have no desire to have a career. Some women absolutely mm-hmm. love being in mm-hmm. the home, being a mom and a wife. And that is great.
Yep.
And, you know, the problems obviously come when that becomes the only way to be a Christian mm-hmm. woman. And for many, many women who are not wired to really find their fulfillment, to feel that they are called in different directions or in multiple directions, and then to be told that you are disobedient and you cannot mm-hmm. be a faithful Christian if you follow what you feel really are, you know, or to use Christian language, the vocation that God has given you. And mm-hmm. that's where the tension emerges. But for some women, they are perfectly content and kind of wired to be that way. And I think that part of the power of these teachings, this ideology, was to tell those women that their life, their way of life was threatened, that they were going to be kind of ripped out of their homes and forced to do something that they didn't want to do by feminism, by the ERA, by big mm-hmm. government, by whatever that the threat of the day might be.
Yep.
Yeah. So we've hit on LGBTQ issues and now feminism. Let's get the evangelical hot button issue trifecta here. Go for the hat trick. Let's talk about racism. So here's just a very direct way to put the question. Is there an evangelicalism without racism?
Yes, there is. And to answer this more fully, though, we're going to have to get into the tricky definition of, you know, what is evangelicalism? What are we talking about? And you'll notice in the subtitle, I was very explicit. This is a story about white evangelicalism. And evangelicalism itself is a term that has really morphed in meaning over time, you know, from the 18th century through the 19th century, early 20th century, mid 20th century. You can kind of trace the shift in meaning that the term connoted at different moments in history. And I mean, that's something I do a little bit in the book and I've done more elsewhere. But what I push back against in this book are attempts to define evangelicalism purely as a set of theological beliefs. So this kind of rubric that, okay, you believe in conversionism, the centrality of the cross, you know, the authority of the Bible, and boom, 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 there you are, an evangelical. And then you just lump all these evangelicals. Because if you do that, then the majority of Black Protestants in the United States are, quote unquote, evangelical. The majority of global Christians, if they're not Catholic, they're going to be evangelical, and which is fine if you're, you know, for some questions. To understand American evangelicalism as a historical and cultural movement, that's where I say that rubric isn't going to get you very far. Because the truth is, most Black Protestants do not identify as evangelical, not at all. And there are very clear reasons for that, right? They do not go to the same churches as white evangelicals, for the most part. They do not read the same books, listen to the same music, listen to the same radio stations, for the most part. So why are we insisting on counting them as the same thing? When we do that, we end up, you know, some scholars or observers will say, see, evangelicalism can't possibly be racist because we're going to include all Black Protestants and global Christians in this. I'm saying no, as a historian and as a cultural historian, I'm going to describe what I'm seeing. And this is a rather distinctive movement with a little bit of overlap, interplay with Black Protestantism, with global Christianity. But we're really looking at a fairly cohesive movement, networks, series of networks, relationships. I look at evangelicalism, again, largely as a consumer culture. Are you formed by these consumer products? And when we're looking at that, then white evangelicalism is its own thing. And when we look at white evangelicalism, then we can ask your question again. Can you be a white evangelical and not be racist? You still can. There is always a kind of minority movement, has always been within white evangelicalism over the last half century. The evangelical left has been very pro-civil rights, anti-racist. You know, this is like the Sojourners folks in the 1960s, 1970s. Tom Skinner is an African-American evangelical. Like, that still is a part of the movement. It's not the dominant part of the movement. And this is where, you know, understanding kind of relations of power and relative power across the movement is important. To understand white evangelicalism, you have to understand the significance of Southern evangelicals in shaping the broader white evangelical movement. You can see that through migration patterns from the Deep South into the Sun Belt, into Southern California, which then goes national, right, with the rise of the religious right. You can look at that in terms of the kind of celebrity culture, the media culture. I mean, John Wayne works in the title in all kinds of different ways. This kind of, you know, Hollywood, Southern California celebrity evangelicalism that develops. And with evangelicalism that we see as it takes shape as a cultural and political movement by the end of the 1970s and afterwards, you cannot separate its whiteness from its religious identity and its religious values, and you cannot fully extricate the racism that is also a part of the movement to greater or lesser degrees. So some white evangelicals, particularly, I think, in the South, in the 1960s, 1970s, yes, they are racist, they are segregationist, they are motivated out of those values. Somebody like Jerry Falwell Sr., right? You have the development of Christian schools, Christian academies that are segregationist academies, and the religious right mobilizes in part to defend those academies on their right to exist. That is absolutely part of the story of white evangelicalism today. It's not the only part. And so again, the interesting thing to me is you've got that strand, you still have racist white evangelicals, but you have the majority of white evangelicals do not think of themselves as racist. They do not hold personal animosity towards people of color, for the most part, right? If somebody would walk into their church, whatever color they were, they'd be warmly welcomed. And so I wanted to understand what kind of accommodations have taken place, what kind of unexamined values that are deeply rooted in whiteness really give shape to white evangelicalism today. And that's where I'd point to, in particular, Christian nationalism, which if you think about it, the idea that America was a Christian nation founded as God's chosen nation, everything was really great until somewhere around the 1960s, right? That only makes sense if you're a white person. Only makes sense. And that, but it's never presented as this is a kind of white religious identity or white religious value. It's just the way things are within conservative evangelical circles. So those were the kinds of things that I really tried to bring out in this book. How race worked, how whiteness worked, to make whiteness visible when so many evangelicals don't make it visible and therefore are not even able to see it themselves.
And some evangelical leaders are skilled at making it invisible.
Yes.
So one thing I've noticed, and I don't know if you've done any specific research on this, but you mentioned something in the book that brings it to mind, is we can kind of mask our racism by attaching racial activism or activism for racial justice to something else that we already know beyond a shadow of a doubt is bad and something we should be against, right? So you mentioned in the book that I think it was Jerry Falwell Sr., equated the civil rights movement with Marxism. And yes. Everybody knows you're supposed to be against the communists. Nobody could define what Marxism is, and nobody's read Marx. But we all know communism is bad.
Very bad.
And today, Black Lives Matter, same thing.
It's
all over again.
Very familiar.
Right? Critical race theory. It's either because they're in favor of LGBTQ stuff or because somehow critical race theory is Marxist. Again, nobody can define Marxism, but we know that's bad.
And very few people can define critical race theory. I mean, that has been fascinating.
Even including critical race theorists.
Fascinating to see in the last 2 years, you know, for me as a cultural historian, as you know, somebody who studies this, to suddenly start hearing all about critical race theory more than I've ever heard about it before.
To hear Tim Keller. Yes. Talk about critical race theory.
Exactly.
I never thought I'd see it.
Exactly. It's and yes, when you know the history, you know, we've seen this before. Yep. So call it Marxist, call it, you know, or much of the opposition to kind of civil rights, post-Civil Rights Act, you know, 1964 and 1965 Voting Rights Act as well. You know, once that was, many, many moderate evangelicals supported that, those measures. So this is a Billy Graham type of, you know, moderate evangelicalism, whereas fundamentalists and some Southern evangelicals still opposed even those measures. But by and large, the majority of evangelicals were okay with that. And then they thought, okay, we're good. That's good. Anything beyond that could easily get dismantled as, you know, disrupting the social order. So law and order politics, really strong by the late 60s and certainly by the 70s in evangelical circles. And yes, Marxism, tying it with Marxism. Also, you know, slightly less extreme, so this isn't socialism or Marxism, but it's big government. And we're anti-big government. And of course, in that moment, what is the big government doing? What is the federal government doing? They are interfering with states' rights in order to enforce desegregation. So again, historical context is just really critical because there are so many of these words that really are racially coded words. Mm-hmm. And evangelicals can use those so fluently and have been for generations that if you don't know the history, it's hard to understand just how racialized those values actually are.
So in chapter 11, otherwise known as the best chapter name in the book, Holy Balls, in the chapter Holy Balls, Kristen, you write pretty extensively about the black hole that is, it was and really is, the testosterone-fueled new Calvinist movement, the neo-reformed guys. And you talk a lot about Mark Driscoll in particular, but there's all these superstar megachurch pastors who, and many of them, have fallen from grace. I mean, it felt like a year and a half where it was just like dominoes falling, whether it's Driscoll or McDonald or C.J. Mahaney, all of them. Do you think these guys had major, they had doctrinal differences that we'll talk about in a little bit, but they really, their theology is very ironclad, and it's really, in many ways, I would say testosterone-fueled, masculine-driven theology, these neo-reform guys. Do you think that theology had anything to do with the way they found them, that their end in, for sure, Driscoll, I'm just going to say ministry-wise, unfortunately, it wasn't the end, but their fall from grace, do you think that had to do anything to do with their theology, actually?
I think it did. There's never a direct route. And then it's like, well, what came first? Were these men drawn mm-hmm. to this theology because of how they were wired, because of who they were, and because of their own maybe excessive testosterone or perception thereof? And were they then drawn to this theology? Then this theology reinforced those behaviors, justified or condoned those behaviors. It's really hard for me to see, because I think it works both ways all the time. Mm-hmm. And then watching how, I mean, in that group in particular, it became really apparent to me just how these networks functioned, and how so many men were drawn to the power of other men and wanting to participate in those networks, want to participate in, to share a stage, to emulate, to pattern their own preaching after somebody like Mark Driscoll. He was enormously popular. And he was one of the guys that early on, back, 15 some years ago, I was looking at and saying, who is this guy? Is he mainstream? Of course, he was hugely popular, the celebrity, but was he popular, I wondered, because the media likes to cover him because he's so egregious? But no, when you look inside evangelicalism, he was so influential for, more than a decade, really, as this model of a successful ministry. And so many evangelical men that I've talked to listened to him for hours on end, his sermons, and so many evangelical pastors wanted to be just like him. And so so that's where, his influence was profound, I think. And so, I'm not sure what ultimately came first, but the theology and the behavior were mutually reinforcing. And that's part of how we got to where we ended up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I mean, we could do another whole episode on Driscoll and his comrades and what they did to the faith, and both in fashion and in theology. Let's be honest. I mean, they're ripped, bedazzled jeans. Mark Driscoll sold many of those fat bracelets and watches. Yes, yes. So in that vein, you talk about this reality that, again, it's one of those things that feels like it's been hiding in plain sight. When you said it, I was like, oh my gosh, yep, that's absolutely right. There's all these reformed leaders within the church, and particularly with 10 years ago or so, who really are quite different, both in the way they carry themselves and the way they preach. Their theology is quite different even, but they kind of banded together, whether it's John Piper, Mark Driscoll, John MacArthur, I mean, these guys are very different.
Doug Wilson, let's throw him in there.
Doug Wilson, oh my God. And you wouldn't expect to see them on the same stage in a million years, but they did, and they celebrated one another, and they overlooked one another's real nasty stuff because they got a few things right. And you make the point that there's these small handful of things, doctrinal things, that if you got them right, you could be part of the brotherhood, which were mostly a doctrine of hell that was dark and scary, believing that homosexuality is a sin, believing in penal substitutionary theory of atonement. That's really important, right? There's a couple of others, but really, and then complementarianism. You have to be complementarian. Those four things were really like, if you're good with all those, you're in our club. That's wild to me.
Yeah.
How do you think that came to be? How do those things rise to the surface?
Oh, I mean, there's no simple answer. There really isn't. Going back to the 1960s is really where I'd want to go back to. That's when you start to see the battle lines really drawn, and who is orthodox and who is not. And yes, gender is very much at the heart of that. And even things like, penal atonement and the existence of hell are also cast in gendered terms as the proper masculine faith, and as the, father punishing the son, and this kind of, harsh discipline, which is just, like, suck it up. This is Christianity kind of thing. And so gender really pervades this for a long time. And still it puzzled me, I think, to see it take shape. And I watched it take shape, because in the 1990s, so I was born in 1976, so I graduated from college in 97 and went off to graduate school. And up until that time, I had been pretty isolated, again, in this ethnic subculture, this Christian Reformed tradition. I went to a Christian Reformed college, very separate from the rest of American Christianity. And then I headed off to study American religious history. And so, again, I'm meeting all these evangelicals, and I'm kind of getting the lay of the land. And that's right around the time that you see the burgeoning of this young, restless, and reformed movement. And I'm hearing about them. And at first, I'm thinking, yes, finally, right? You know, I'd been in this little enclave, and these are my people. Like, good for us, right? You know, we are, you know, John Piper, reformed. I'm reformed. This is awesome. And I was in a Bible study, and of course we were reading John Piper, because what else would you read if you're in an intervarsity Bible study, right, in the 90s? And then increasingly I came to see, well, gradually, I don't think I am this, right? And they certainly don't think that I would be one of them, right? I'm not complementarian. I took an entire course in the Institutes of the Christian Religion, right? Calvin's Institutes. I know my Reformed theology. I've been immersed in it. I'm a scholar, right? All that stuff would count for nothing. I would never share a stage with Piper unless I'm going to be, you know, on the side talking to the wives, telling them to be complementarian kind of thing, right? And that's when I understood how boundaries are drawn, right? And so what is uniting people? And is it the historic Christian faith? Is it apostolic faith? Is it, you know, what is? No, it's not. That's not enough. It's absolutely not enough. It's this set of issues, and it's a very gendered set of issues. And I was de facto excluded from that. And that's kind of this personal realization that came only very gradually, which I think is then I was trying to make sense of in this book as well.
Mm-hmm. So you, Kristen, you've kind of left yourself off the hook for my next question then, which is another jaw-dropping moment when I saw on Twitter that you consider yourself reformed. Like, that you're just not trying to make your parents angry, right? You're not really reformed, are you?
So that's so funny, that moment where I came out on Twitter as reformed, right? I mean, I teach at Calvin University. What do you expect? Yes, I'm very deeply reformed. But the reformed Christianity that I was introduced to was filtered through some of my undergraduate professors, none of whom were American. They were all Dutch or Dutch Canadian. And so the Reformed theology that I embraced was not in any way tainted by, you know, Christian nationalism, by American politics more generally. In fact, it was often set against that. It was more influenced by, you know, kind of Dutch thinking, going back to even World War II, kind of anti-authoritarian, and very much an interpretation of Calvin that was not scholastic, not about the rules and enforcing. It was one that was life-giving, mm-hmm. that was a much warmer and fuzzier version of of Calvin. And that's how I read the Institutes, with that framework in mind, and had those parts of the tradition really just held out for me. And that has always been my Calvinism. And that's very much the Calvinism of Calvin University as well, where I teach. So I'm not alone. I'm not an outlier. I mean, in the broader landscape, absolutely. But I've always been in that tradition, and not the John Piper, Mark Driscoll, and certainly not the Doug Wilson sort.
Praise the Lord. Yep. So, Kristen, last chance. This is not this video won't make it public. So could you just wink twice if you're not really reformed?
She winked. I don't know. Her word against mine now. So while we're on this theme of theology, how important do you think that theology really is or has been to evangelicals, if a lot of these things that are supposedly denominational distinctives can be given up so easily, as long as, you know, you're a complementarian or whatever? How important do you think theology really is to conservative white evangelicals? So, for example, when you're talking in the book about the SBC takeover in 1979, you say that inerrancy, which we think of as, my God, if there's a defining thing for evangelicals, it's that. Inerrancy mattered because of its connection to cultural and political issues. And then the implication is, of course, not the other way around. So this suggests that maybe theology hasn't been of essential importance. But at another place in the book, you talk about this quip that was used, you know, Jesus can save your soul, but John Wayne will save your ass, right?
It's amazing.
So I think it's another one of the great, great chapter titles. So this implies a kind of theological bifurcation of the spiritual and the material. And that still seems, I mean, that's like deeply within Protestantism. It still seems to be with a lot of American evangelicals. And it might explain a good chunk of Trump's Christian support at this point, because you hear all the time people saying, well, you know, yeah, he might not be the best Christian ever, but that's not why I'm voting for him. I'm not voting for a savior. I'm voting for somebody to kick the asses of the people whose asses need to be kicked. So help us understand this trade-off between theological commitment and political expediency.
Yeah. So, you know, evangelicals will self-identify first and foremost as Bible-believing Christians, and will particularly evangelical elites, who are the ones generally defining evangelicalism, are going to absolutely, again, point to these this theological rubric, right? If you check these theological boxes, you are an evangelical. However, when you look at survey data, you can quickly see that, and this is surveys that are you know, set up by evangelical organizations, you can see that there is an alarming level of theological illiteracy within evangelicalism. In fact, an astonishing number of evangelicals hold views traditionally considered heretical, right? And so I absolutely saw this in my own encounters with my own students, many of whom are coming from evangelical backgrounds, that there is little theological knowledge, which made me wonder, all right, so if they don't know their theology, why is the theology considered fundamental here? But the first thing that tipped me off, honestly, was back at the very beginning when my students brought me the book Wild at Heart, and I was like, okay, let me read this. And I was shocked at how little of the Bible there was in it, right? Again, self-identifying Bible-believing Christians, and there's going to be a sprinkling of Bible verses completely decontextualized, right? But really there, it was Hollywood heroes that Eldridge turned to, particularly Mel Gibson's William Wallace, right, as this heroic model of masculinity, therefore model of Christian masculinity, and then cowboys and soldiers, and, you know, later folks like John Wayne and so on. So again, I was early on very suspicious about the centrality of theology. Now, that does not mean that theology does not matter. It just doesn't matter in the way that many evangelicals claim it does. That the interaction between cultural values, cultural commitments, and yes, political commitments, and theology is very much a two-way street. Whereas evangelicals will say, I believe, and therefore I do this, or I have this theological view, or political view, right? The theology always precedes social and cultural and political values. And that is just not historically supportable. And so you see much more of a two-way street there. And the example of SBC and inerrancy is an example of that, where certain theological commitments become the be-all, end-all. And then others are cast aside. And so for me, it became really interesting to see which Bible verses were really upheld as, you know, gospel truth and the guide to living a Christian life, and especially which ones were not. So, you know, turn the other cheek. Nope, we're going to dispense with that. Like, they will literally say, no, we're not doing that. Doesn't apply to us. You know, love your neighbor as yourself, love your enemies, these sorts of things explained away, welcome the stranger, right? All of these things, nope. I mean, the fruits of the spirit, essentially, the fruit of the spirit for the male sex, nope, doesn't apply. So we just need to be much more curious about this relationship between theology and cultural and political values, and not take evangelicals at their word. And as soon as you kind of present these case studies, I think it becomes really clear. And evangelicals themselves, in fact, who have read this book, often come away convinced that you're right. The stories we've been telling ourselves do not hold up under scrutiny.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that chapter was, I think, probably the one that hurt personally a little bit for me in a really healthy way, right? Because for the most part, I mean, even though I grew up evangelical, I always thought James Dobson was kind of out there. And I mean, all the characters in your book, and by characters, I don't mean fake people, I mean real hugely followed evangelical leaders, but I read Wild at Heart when I was in college, and that like sang to my cute little manly heart. You know, it made me feel like such a man. And when you talked about William Wallace and how basically,
I
had this moment where I had this moment where I was like, holy cow, I think I grew into college and into my young adulthood thinking that Jesus is like William Wallace. And I think probably there's a lot of listeners who are like, Jesus is like William Wallace. He's a freedom fighter, you know, like the book of Revelation. And that one I had to unpack a little bit about how much of my theology in my young adulthood, which is very formative, by the way, was formed by Braveheart, William Wallace, Wild at Heart, that whole deal. Whoa, that's intense.
I mean, I've literally received hundreds of messages from evangelicals, especially evangelical men, since this book has come out, and you know, some version of that, of just realizing how much this has shaped their faith. And the movie Braveheart was 96, and that's really when you very soon after start to see this kind of backlash against the soft patriarchy of the Promise Keepers. And then by 2001, that's when Eldridge's book comes out, just months before 9/11, and kind of we know the rest of the story.
I'm feeling like I'm sitting under analysis at the moment, remembering all this stuff. Yes. Like, I would have been 10 years old when Braveheart came out, which just strikes me. Like, I've been a pacifist and a feminist for years, and I still cannot watch that movie without bawling like a child. And a lot of it, I'm realizing, is like subcognitive, right? Yeah. A lot of race, philosophers of race, for example, have talked about how racism is embodied. It's not changing your mind about it doesn't seem to actually change your interactions with people of color. And I'm thinking, shit, the same thing's happening here when I watch Braveheart, right? I don't believe that stuff anymore, but man, I feel it.
Part of, I think, what I've observed in your book as well, that maybe even the main reason why evangelicalism is what it is today, is this constant obsession with power, this constant obsession with having a relevant and meaningful voice in the culture, in the world around us, having political influence, having, you know, and if the scientists don't agree with us, we're going to have our own scientists. And this lust for power is this real, if you start pulling that thread, almost all of evangelicalism seems like it just totally unravels.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thread of the book. That, when I have to really simplify, this is a book about power. It's a book about grasping for power. And so to get back to that kind of juxtaposition of the, you know, Jesus will save your soul, John Wayne will save your ass. Ultimately, the needing a John Wayne to save your ass or a Donald Trump to, you know, bust up all your enemies, that is at its heart a theological claim, right? So there is a theology there. And that really is what I'm getting at in the subtitle, the corrupted of faith part. The fact that, you know, the Jesus of the Gospels does get transformed into this ruthless warrior Christ who's going to slay his enemies. And let me just note, too, that that's not a historical claim, the corrupted of faith part. That's my part is, okay, I'm going to speak right now to evangelicals themselves, because this book is largely a history. But it is framed with this kind of critical framing, right? And a religious critique. As a person of faith myself, I'm bringing that in. And I just wanted to speak to evangelicals very clearly. Again, you self-identify as this. This is what you claim to hold as truth. Here's what we see in front of us. And so the corrupted of faith part is exactly that. That I think fundamentally, as I understand the story of the Gospels and really the story of Christianity, and who Christ is, it is this countercultural narrative of, you know, Christ divesting himself of power and offering himself for the redemption of the world. And so to then transform that faith into one that is ever grasping for power and maintaining that power and then using that power coercively, to me, that is ultimately the corruption of the faith that as I understand it. So yeah, there's a theological claim there.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC. And if you're not, remember to support local.
One more time, that's storyhillbkc.com.
So on this connection, and let me preface this by saying that I have no actual critiques of the book. I loved every part of it, except for the parts that made me hate my childhood. So this is not a critique whatsoever. It's an honest question. This connection between people like John Wayne or Oliver North or the other heroes of militant masculinity, Teddy Roosevelt, whatever, those guys on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other, okay? So a large part of the end of the book is making that connection between how we can understand the almost wholesale embrace of Donald Trump by white evangelicals because of this militant masculinity thing that they had long since imbibed. For my part, it doesn't make sense to me, because when I look at Donald, like the argument makes sense, and I totally grant all of the historical details that you provide. But when I look at Donald Trump, I do not see masculinity. I do not see John Wayne. I do not see Oliver North. I mean, the guy wouldn't know a bench press from a French press. You know what I mean? Like he's literally an overweight, draft-dodging, wishy-washy, believes the last thing that was told to him, amoral, inheritance billionaire.
Yes.
He's not Teddy Roosevelt. So I guess my question then is, do you think white evangelicals who have embraced him really believe their own propaganda about his masculinity?
So, I mean, there are always multiple masculinities. And I think that what's key to is a lot of people say, like, again, Donald Trump isn't masculine, but he is performing masculinity in a certain type of masculinity. And he's performing masculinity in a throwback way, a very retrograde way, throwing back to the 1950s masculinity. And you know, that comes through clearly towards the end of the book, that, you know, people campaigning keep saying this is John Wayne America. He's a symbol of John Wayne America. He's a symbol of he's a 1950s man. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, like, it's very clear what they're doing. John Wayne was a symbol of throwback masculinity, right? To the cowboy, this you know, and the cowboys themselves were always kind of nostalgic for a time when, you know, white men wielded power. And so really what the thread is, I think, that I would pull through there is the masculine right and duty to wield power. This is a very racialized conception of masculinity. So it's the white man's obligation to use violence to bring order. And that's where you see the cowboys of the Wild West, John Wayne in all of his movies, and in all of his movies, a distinctively white man using violence to subdue, in most cases, non-white populations, right? Sands of Iwo Jima, Green Berets, the Alamo. This is just kind of this cultural ideal of American masculinity. That's what we're talking about. So Donald Trump, that's kind of the strand that he is going to pull through. And it becomes, in some cases, more extreme because of this culture wars context, because of this battle against feminism, against liberalism, against political correctness. And that's important to understand, like, by the 2000s, you know, political correctness becomes, you know, this great threat. And what does it actually threaten? You shouldn't be rude anymore. You shouldn't be racist. You shouldn't, you know, what is it really threatening? It's threatening this ability to, particularly for men, for white men, to say what needs to be said, to do what needs to be done, to wield their power that they, you know, perceive themselves to have a right to wield. And that's the masculinity that Trump is so unapologetically embodying in a way that is astounding, right? It is still astounding to all of us on a daily basis. What even is this? Every tweet, every statement he makes, practically, it's completely like we are in a new era. And so he has really taken that, you know, thumbing his nose at political correctness, at civility, at, you know, following any rules at all. And so he's just like on steroids, taking that fearlessness, that ruthlessness, do what needs to be done for the sake of righteousness. And who's going to define the righteousness? And that's where we see the symbiotic relationship between Trump and his evangelical supporters. And they have embraced him. He has embraced them. And he is on their side. And then he is on God's side. So that is really the strand that I would pull through. He's certainly not my ideal of masculinity, but the power that he wields, the way that he wields that power, is playing on a long history of white masculine power.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you spoke to that in the introduction, which was fantastic, but basically saying, I'm going to be making the case in this book that this reality that we hear about, that 81% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump, but they did it while holding their nose and really were kind of ashamed of it. You said, that's really not the case. And I'm going to make the case. And sure enough, you made the case. I mean, it didn't take very far in the book for me to be like, yeah, I mean, this whole thing's been built on, like having a guy like Donald Trump be the end all be all. And that's where I would say, I fully agree with you that Donald Trump's version of masculinity is a version of masculinity that we find in many, many fundamentalist and evangelical white churches. It's our idea of masculinity, this broken masculinity where strength looks like bullying. And it looks like me getting the upper hand in every conversation. I mean, you just look at the first debate this last election season, and that's what masculinity looks like to many, many white evangelicals, and especially males. And that's where I think that's the perfect picture of why he resonated so deeply with so many evangelicals, even though they try... I'm getting a little bit us versus them here, a little bit. That's where I think he's the perfect representation in many ways of that movement, unfortunately.
So I have one more question I just have to ask, and then I'll let Randy finish it up however he wants. So my wife and I are huge fans of Fred Rogers, and we just recently read his biography. It's called The Good Neighbor by Maxwell King. One of the things, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, one of the things that saved me, I think, from this militant masculinity of evangelicalism was that I had his influence, which was kind of historically accidental. He just happened to be on television when I was a kid. And so now looking back at that and learning more about him, I'm seeing, wow, I didn't realize there were these two competing conceptions of masculinity at war socially and even within my own head. And I'm really grateful that there were. So in some ways, it seems to me like many of the major political disagreements we're dealing with right now, almost, this is reductionist to say, but it almost boils down to those who followed Spock and Rogers and those who followed Dobson and John Wayne, you know? And recently at Biden's town hall, one of Trump's political advisors tweeted, "It's like watching Mr. Rogers."
Yes.
And she thought it was an insult.
Exactly. Exactly. You can see the divide on Twitter, right? Like, that's awesome, right? Exactly. Right? Yeah. Fred Rogers was interesting. I mean, but first of all, Spock, yes. The Spock connection. So Dobson, so anti-Spock, you know, and he's trying to redeem American children from the damage that Spock had done. And of course, Spock, after he retired, ended up becoming an anti-war activist. So, you know, that was just against all these deeply held values, including militarism. We haven't talked much about militarism, but militarism being, you know, a kind of fundamental value of conservative evangelicalism, really. I mean, you could go to the 1940s, but certainly by the 1960s as a distinctive value that set them apart from many other Americans who were becoming a lot more ambivalent towards the war and war in general. So Spock was seen as very dangerous. And what was fascinating to me in this research was to see just how often family values, like really family, you know, raising your kids, husband, wife, having sex, these kinds of very intimate relationships were always connected to bigger issues. They were always connected to foreign policy. They were always connected to the youth rebellion, to authority and hierarchy in society at large. And so family values were inherently, right, political, not just in the sense that we understand them, but in this very broad sense. And so Dobson was really against Spock and all that he stood for. And then, even John Wayne is coming out against Benjamin Spock, right? And blaming Benjamin Spock for the hippies and the throwing off of the authority of their parents, by which they meant patriarchal authority, right? Because which of the parents really has the authority there? And then, Fred Rogers, conservative evangelicals, not a fan. And all this literature on militant masculinity, I mean, they're making that very clear. Like, you know, Jesus was much more like William Wallace than like, you know, Mr. Rogers. or Mother Teresa. And so they're very clear. And yes, he is an emasculated man. He is exactly what is wrong with America. And if America raises their children, especially their boys, according to the values of Fred Rogers, right, the end is near, because we will not be able to defend ourselves against the very real enemies that await.
I'm guessing since it was published this year, you probably finished it last year or thereabouts. Would it be any different if it had been published now? Is there anything that happened in 2020, the 10 years of 2020, you that would have made it into the book?
When I finished this book, I mean, it's been described by reviewers as urgent and sharp elbowed. And I really like that description. Had I absorbed 2020, I think the elbows would have been even sharper, right? I think a constant struggle as I wrote this book, just kind of internal as a writer, was, you know, what is mainstream? What is fringe? How does this all fit together? How bad is this? And what I was looking at, I thought, this is really bad. I'd been living with this for years. And then those last 3 years, really, I was deeply researching and writing the book, right, from 2016 on. I just thought, this is really bad. This is looking really bad. So much so when I got to the end of the manuscript and my editor read it the first time through, at the end, he just said, could you give us a little hope in the conclusion? And I wrote back to him saying, I thought about it. I was like, what can I do with this? And I was like, I don't think I can. I'm feeling as heavy as you are right now. This is the history I uncovered. I've got nothing else. And then he's like, okay, I respect that. And then a couple days later, I get another email. Could you just give us something, Kristen? Like, we need something. We can't end with this. And that's when I gave him the last sentence of the book. And what was once done can also be undone. And honestly, at the time, it felt so flaky. It felt like, you know, this is all I've got. He's like, fine, we'll take it. But I do really believe that. Like, there is, knowing history, knowing how we got to this point, can give us a chance to undo it. That said, it is what we are seeing now is so deeply embedded that it's hard not to be pessimistic. Once you know this history, right? You know just how deep this is. This is not a little misunderstanding. This is not a let's open our Bibles together kind of thing and we'll clear this up, right? Mm-hmm. That's not going to work here. And so 2020 has not changed the book or the conclusions at all. If anything, it has hardened those conclusions. I think we saw with the response to the coronavirus, saw the extent of this ideology taken to extremes that even I could not have anticipated. When people's own lives and the lives of their loved ones are very clearly at stake. I mean, they've been talking for decades about, you know, threats to the family, threats to America, communism, radical Islam, secular humanism. You know, now we really have something that is literally killing hundreds of thousands of us. And it didn't really touch this because the ideology was such that the enemy was not the virus. The enemy was masks or mask mandates or liberals or China or, you know, it was defined otherwise. Survey data just continues to demonstrate this kind of loyalty to the ideology and to the Trump administration among white evangelicals. The Black Lives Matter movement revealed once again the extent of white evangelical racism and resistance to anti-racist efforts. And so, and again, the loyalty of white evangelical leaders to the Trump administration. So no, more of the same. 2020 is absolutely more of the same and more profoundly so. The question is, what happens next, right? What happens post-inauguration? What happens to this movement? Historically, we've seen that it's usually when conservative evangelicals are out of power that they become most powerful, that they really, become more radicalized.
They thrive on it.
And they give a lot more money to their organizations. They become, they really renew their power. Under the presidency of Donald Trump was the first time that they kind of had one of their own in the White House where their power was not diminished. They didn't kind of fall apart as they did during the end of the Reagan years or the Bush years and, you know, kind of need to regroup. And then, you know, Barack Obama was this godsend because he was, you know, this enemy. And so they could coalesce again. Donald Trump had this uncanny ability to both give them access and privilege and power and continue to daily, hourly kind of incite resentment and fear and continue to stoke that. So what happens once he leaves office is a huge question to me. What are the dynamics going to look like? Are we going to see a further radicalization, or without him kind of tweeting from the Oval Office every day is and when he looks like a loser, is his power going to actually be diminished? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would completely agree with your take on white evangelicalism and the future of it. I mean, it's why the church that I pastor, we decided to drop the evangelical label, because we for years have been like, we can do this. We can change evangelicalism. We can be the ones, you know, and it's just, no, we can't. I mean, it's left the building. And we actually said we dropped the label evangelical for the sake of the gospel.
Yeah.
Because the gospel is too valuable. It's been diminished by this movement. So you said it's been described, your book, as having sharp elbows, and I will affirm and confirm that. But the beautiful part about it, Kristen, is you really didn't slam. There was no opinion in here. It's just a history book. You're just quoting people. You're just literally going through the history and saying, this is what it is. This is what it is, just so you know, and letting everybody draw their own conclusion. It's the best way to have sharp elbows is just data and statistics, right? However, doing something that is very challenging to a huge movement that's seen as very much at the center of the gospel or at the center of Jesus, that comes at a cost. You know, like I know from being a church leader that saying things that might be true and real that might hurt comes at a cost. I'm sure I have no idea how much hate mail or hate tweets you've gotten as a result of this, but I want to know, what has writing this book done to your soul, Kristen? I mean, maybe both in good and bad ways. Like, is your family okay with everything? Have your relationships been affected by it? Like, what has it done to not Dr. Kristen Kobus Dume, but Kristen?
Oh, this is getting personal. let's see. First, I will say that I anticipated that this would come with a cost, publishing this book. The cost has been much less than I feared. I have gotten almost no hate mail. I know it's shocking. My publisher's lawyer had warned me to, you know, prepare myself for vicious trolling, and kind of I locked things down a bit as the book came out. I've had just a little bit of that, not much at all thus far. And I've received fewer than a handful of negative letters of any sort, like not even mean-spirited. I think there's maybe one that got kind of unpleasant and I cut off that communication. That's it. But then there's still the personal, right? There's the fact mm-hmm. that I personally am deeply embedded in these communities, and my own relationships often cross over this political chasm. And that has been really hard. That was hard before I started writing this book. It became harder as I was writing this book. And there have been some really hard moments. I really think that in this historical moment, I think we're all called to be faithful, as faithful as we can be, and we're called, and that will require courage. And that there are so many forces within evangelicalism, I think, that work against that. You know, be nice. Don't disrupt. Don't disrupt your church. Don't disrupt relationships. Don't rock the boat. Don't tarnish the church's witness. Don't, you know, even that original impulse of mine, that sounded kind of noble, and it felt noble at the time. You know, do I really want to shine this bright light on the dark underside of American evangelicalism, right? Was that a good impulse? Or was that just brand protection? And is that exactly what has gotten us where we are now? I wasn't going to follow the truth that I saw in front of me. And so I set it aside. And so I think this is a moment that each of us has to ask, you know, what is required of us? How are we positioned? And there are going to be costs. Sometimes those costs aren't going to be as dire as we fear. Sometimes they will be. I know many people who have lost their jobs over speaking out, speaking into this moment. I know many families that have been deeply divided. And I know lots of churches that have really struggled, and relationships that have been broken. And so I think that there's a cost for all of us. I will also say that when you make that choice, and if you can do so with as much grace and truth as you can muster, you also find others who are doing that. And the support that I've received has been just phenomenal. It comes with cost, but also, to use a very evangelical word, with great blessing too.
Well, I mean, Kristen, thank you for having the bravery to write this book. And can I just say, in honor of your chapters, thanks for having the balls to write this book. I mean, it's amazing. But I really, absolutely. I really do
there's
think
there's an ironic
that,
ending to this. Yeah. So.
But I really do think that this could be the work, the book that 10 years from now we look back on and say, this was the book that gave a bunch of people permission to say, that's not me anymore. I can't do it anymore. I side with Jesus more than I side with the evangelical movement, with white evangelical movement. I side with the gospel more than I identify as an evangelical, and I can't do it anymore. And so it's just a very, very important book. Last question. You have another book coming out called Live, Laugh, Love, I believe, right?
Yes.
I saw a little teaser on Twitter. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Because it sounds incredible.
Oh, I just can't wait. Yeah, I'm ready to leave this testosterone-filled masculinity behind, but you never really can, I've learned. But so my next book is kind of the flip side. It is A Cultural History of White Christian Womanhood. It's been on my radar for so, so long. And even as I was writing Jesus and John Wayne, and I was writing about Phyllis Schlafly and Maribel Morgan, Elizabeth Elliot, I knew that there was the rest of that story that I didn't have time to get into, because Elizabeth Elliot is still influential. But right now it's we've moved on. We have Janet Oak, and we have Beverly Lewis, and we have mommy bloggers, and we have a multi-level marketing and Hallmark movies and HGTV. And that's really this purveyor of white Christian womanhood as a cultural ideal. And so I really want to investigate that. And what does that do if culture really does shape theology? What does that do? What does that do to Christianity? What does that do to theology? What does that do to politics? And so it's a super fun project. I'm now watching Hallmark movies in my spare time, reading a lot of really bad novels and, inspirational fiction. And it is absolutely a blast. So yes, Live, Laugh, Love will be out in, I think,
2023. Reading inspirational fiction as fun. Whoa.
It's got to be better than listening to Mark Driscoll sermons on repeat.
The book is Jesus and John Wayne again. Dr. Kristen Cobus-Dume, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for the time.
Oh, thank you. This was absolutely great.
Thanks for spending this time with us. We really hope that you're enjoying these conversations as much as we are. And if you are, help us get the word out. Before you close your podcast app, leave a rating or a review. That helps new listeners find us, maybe for the first time. If you'd like to share the episode you just heard with a friend or a family member, you can find those links on our social media pages. You can also find us over on Patreon at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. And that's going to work well for you, whether you're a kind enough person to financially support us out of the goodness of your heart, or if you're just looking for merch or the chance for a private tasting. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.